last week was the lowest of the low point in this. We had the case of, just a quick review, the concubine who was raped and killed, and her husband then chopped her up, sent her to all 12, chopped up 12 pieces. That had to be an interesting endeavor. Sent her to all 12 tribes. The response of the tribes was indignation. They, you know, for the first time in the book, without a judge, it's kind of weird that many people think it happened very early in the history of Israel. And that's why they can still gather together, because they were used to fighting and what was left over after conquering the land. So a call goes out, every tribe report to Mizpah, which means watchtower. So they go there, they have a meeting, they decide that they're going to deal with these guys and Gilgal and that have done this dastardly thing. So they send word to the Benjamites saying, come join us and deal with these guys that have done this. And I guess the point kind of like you get kind of throughout the narrative, they never seek God's counsel. They always make a decision and then ask God to join in their decision, which is kind of the New Testament thing you can point out of there. How many times in our lives did we pay, your will be done as long as it's this? You know, that kind of thing that we get out of it. So they meet there. The tribe of Benjamin responds in a very strange way, you would think, but you got to think they're all relatives. This is family. So the tribe of Benjamin responds to the call and basically says, no, we're not going to hand over these guys. Matter of fact, we're going to fight with these guys. So you basically have 400,000 out of all the other tribes. Now, was there some of the tribe of Benjamin in there? I don't know. I don't know if it's relative to the story. But you have all these, so you have 400,000 people against 26,500. The first time they said, they went to God and said, should we go fight the Benjamins? And he said, yep. So they go up there and they lose 20,000 men the first day, the other 11 tribes. Because remember, the Benjamites from the story of Ehud, they were left-handed, which if you study history, the way all of history, you held your shield in your left hand and your sword in your right. So you could fight a blow coming from the right-hand side was the way you were designed to fight. So if somebody was left-handed and could fight, they were at a real, real advantage because you were having to fight across your body and not be able to strike back. So it was a real advantage being left-handed in that. So they end up, so they go, they lose 20,000 guys, they go back and they say, God, I kind of messed that up. The first time they say, who should go up first? And he said, send Judah. So they just march up, lose 20,000 men, come back, they're wailing and gnashing, they go before God and said, should we fight, should we really do this? Should we fight the Benjamites? And he says, yes. Well, they go up, they lose 18,000 more people. So here's this, for me, it's a weird seeing, and I don't know what their lives are, but you see innocent people, quote unquote, I don't know what they're, that are dying, that all goes back to a sin that wasn't dealt with the original, you can make the argument that maybe the husband mistreated, she was a concubine, so she was a second class wife. So did he mistreat her in such a way? But the bottom line is she played the whore, is what the Bible says. So she committed adultery and fled to her father's house. Now, under the law, there was a punishment for that. But this guy evidently felt, for whatever reason, and it took him 4 months to come to that conclusion, we all been there, that, no, I really like this girl, I'm going to go, and he went and met her father, and he did. But all these people died from that sin not being dealt with at the root cause. And now you come all the way to this. But again, just like in the Samson story, there was a sin festering in this town and in this tribe that needed to be dealt with. So in God's great design of things, he allowed all this to happen to bring about what's going to happen. So long story short, they lose 2 days in a row, the 11 tribes, that's for a better, lack of a better term, lose to the Benjamites. Well, they finally go before the Lord and they're offering sacrifices and weeping and saying, what's going on? Should we fight against them? And the Lord says, yes, fight against them. I have given them into your hand. And that's the first time they never inquired of the Lord. They just said, should we go fight? And they never inquired, are we going to win? So I kind of feel like God just kept letting them. He said, until you get to the point you're going to ask me what the outcome's going to be, I'm going to let you learn your lesson. So long story short, they wipe them out, and that's where I kind of thought there was 600 that fled to the Rock of Ramon, and that's what's up here on the screen. And so they're hiding kind of in this defensible position where I guess nobody could get to them. So the men at the very last of the last chapter, so it says, the men of Israel went back to Benjamin and put all the towns to the sword, including the animals and everything else they found, and the towns they came across were set on fire. So they destroyed the tribe of Benjamin, less the 600 guys that are hiding in these rocks. So once, you know, the dogs of war are unleashed, man's inhumanity to man pretty much knows no bounds. And my confession is I always fall back on the scene where Jesus is at the Last Supper with the disciples and he says, one of you is going to betray me. And you would think these guys have been with Jesus and you kind of think you know them, and Peter, and they all are like, is it me, Lord? Because I think in their final revelation of themselves, of course 15 minutes later they're fighting over who's the greatest, for a minute they realize, all of us, what we are capable of as human beings. And that's what's on display here, that once the bounds have been, you know, the boundaries have been blurred, and we're seeing this in our own country, be it sexuality, be it criminality, be it, you know, once the lines get blurred. And I almost cut out, I read a real good article this week about, you know, as we start to parade what we think is compassion, it can become enabling. And we've seen that a lot of people have dealt with, you know, addictions in your family and stuff like that. And a lot of people, in the name of compassion, are trying to help somebody genuinely, and they are just beyond help at that moment. That doesn't mean they're not redeemable or whatever. But then it ends up, you know, people steal and people rob and kill, and just because people showed compassion. So it's tough just in our human form to know what that boundary is between the law and compassion. And I guess that's what this story. So that's where we pick it up. So they've wiped out the whole tribe of Benjamin, less 600 guys. So we're going to find out some interesting things here. All right, verse 1. So the men of Israel have taken a vow at Mizpah, not one of us will give his daughter in marriage to a Benjamin. Well, this is kind of an interesting thing, because that's what I told you earlier in the narrative, that, you know, they made... So you're going to see a pattern here where they get in the heat of battle and you make these rash vows, and contrast it to the chapters before where... Samson, his life was supposed to be a vow, and he took nothing serious. And here these guys are making these rash vows, but they do it before the whole congregation, so they're saddled with it. And obviously this is the first, you know, maybe not the first in the Bible, but they bring on board some good lawyers to try to weasel around their little their problems. So it says, the people went to Bethel, where they sat before God until evening, raising their voices and weeping bitterly. "Lord God of Israel," they cried, "why has this happened to Israel? Why should one tribe be missing from Israel today?" And it's kind of, and it says, early the next day, the people built an altar and presented burnt offerings and fellowship offerings. So you wonder if they had kind of, this is like step D in this process, if they had made this step A in the beginning of this and really got down on their knees and worshipped and went before the Lord and said, "What do we do?" that there might have been a different outcome. And I don't know, there's, you know, that's speculation, so I can't prove that. But you just wonder if, you know, they had kind of done things in a different order instead of, you know, in our flesh, they, you know, these girls cut up and they find out the story and they just, we're ready to have blood. And you never know if that had been presented to the Lord, he might have dealt with the Benjamites a little differently or whatever. I don't know, but there it is.
Great. What's interesting, you see a bad pattern here because they build an altar.
I couldn't hear you. Because
sorry. I said it's a bad pattern. It starts wrong because they build an altar. The law says
no altars except in
the ones at the
temple. Yep. So, yeah. But it says, so then verse 5, the Israelites asked, "Who from all the tribes of Israel has failed to assemble before the Lord?" For they had taken a solemn oath that anyone who failed to assemble before the Lord at Mizpah would be put to death. So here you have this again. In the heat of battle, in a moment of flaming passion, you make a whole bunch of rash vows. And it's terrible. I think of a movie in the 80s that had Burt Reynolds in it. I don't know. I always think about it. He decided to commit suicide. So he swims real far out in the ocean. And then he changes his mind. And he starts swimming back. And he's like, "Lord, if you just let me get back to the shore, I'll give you everything." So he keeps swimming. He gets a little closer. He's like, "Lord, if I get there, I'll give you 75%. Then he gets a little closer, and he's like, "Lord, if you let me get there, it's 50. And you get, by the time he gets back to the beach, he's like, "Thanks, Lord, we'll call it even." You know, so, you know, it's kind of funny that we, you know, you can make these vows and then not take them seriously, but at least these guys take the vow seriously. But you can see they, A, decided none of their daughters are going to marry these guys, and now they're going to go kill a bunch more people that didn't show up for the party. So now Israel grieved for the tribe of Benjamin, their fellow Israelites. "Today one tribe is cut off from Israel," they said. "How can we provide wives for those who are left, since we have taken an oath by the Lord not to give any of them our daughters in marriage?" So then the lawyers get involved. So then they ask, "Which one of the tribes of Israel failed to assemble before the Lord at Mizpah?" And they discovered that no one from Jabesh Gilead had come to the camp for the assembly. For when they counted the people, they found that none of the people from Jabesh Gilead were there. So I gave you real quick. So you can see the tribe of Benjamin is kind of this tan-colored place in here. And then on here, which would be green here. And here's the city. So it's kind of down in here. So it's kind of from the tribe of Reuben. But it's just, sometimes I need to see what's going on to understand a little bit. I don't know if that helps anybody but me or not. So it says, "So the assembly sent 12,000 fighting men with instructions to go to Jabesh Gilead and put to the sword those living there, killing the women and children," which is all interesting. "This is what you are to do," they said, "kill every male and every woman who is not a virgin." They found among the people living in Jabesh Gilead 400 young women who had never slept with a man, and they took them to the camp at Shiloh and Caleb. So, like I said, the lawyers got involved and decided, hey, here's a way around this. We told these guys we were going to kill them if they didn't come. They didn't come, so we're going to go kill them. And guess what? They have some daughters that are still virgins. So here's a little caveat around our law that we made that, you know, we could shed some more blood and get around this. So that's where it is, and they and the people and the whole assembly set to offer a peace to the Benjamites at the Rock of Ramah. So they basically, this is a formal thing where they go and offer them a treaty that says, look, we're not going to kill you. Because obviously, you know, you're only 600 guys left. They've killed everybody else that you know. You're not going to come out of that rock without a lot of promises. So this is a formal treaty between them. And so the Benjamites returned at that time and were given the women of Jabesh-Gilead who had been spared, but there were not enough for all of them. So basically, there were 600 guys, there was 400 virgins they were given, so it still leaves 200 guys in the house. So the people grieved for Benjamin because the Lord had made a gap in the tribe of Israel. And it's kind of interesting here that they say, for the Lord had made a gap in the tribe of Israel. It's kind of, it's like, I haven't seen God say a whole lot in this thing. You're kind of on your own, and now God's involved. Before you got started, you didn't talk to him, and now you want to blame him for stuff. But... yep. So the elders of the assembly said, with the women of Benjamin destroyed, how shall we provide wives for the men who are left? And the Benjamite survivors must have heirs, they said, so that the tribe of Israel will not be wiped out. So it's kind of interesting, you kind of look at some of the, what had happened if the tribe of Benjamin had been wiped out and there was never no, so Saul, the first king of Israel, would have never existed. They are a tribe that stayed with Judah during the split. There's always this thing about the 10 lost tribes. Well, now you're down to 9 anyway, because one tribe stayed with Israel, or Judah. And Mordecai was a Benjamite. If you remember the story of Ruth, her uncle was a Benjamite. And the other Saul in the Bible, who we end up knowing as Paul, was a Benjamite. So here is like the precipice of, you know, that, what do they call it, the butterfly effect, if a butterfly flaps its wings and the wind moves somewhere. But it just shows throughout time the effect that, you know, one action, one person, one thing can have on the future. But so I just looked up some famous people that have been with Benjamites. So, again, the lawyers step in. We can't give our daughters as wives since we Israelites have taken this oath. Cursed be anyone who gives his wife to a Benjamite. But look, there is an annual festival of the Lord in Shiloh. So I got to think, it's kind of interesting that every time at this point they mention, first they're blaming stuff on the Lord, and then there's this festival of people worshiping the Lord, and they're going to use that for a devious purpose. In Shiloh, which lies north of Bethel, east of the road that goes from Bethel to Shechem and south of Lebanon. So I didn't go through all that. I don't think it really matters in this part of the... So they instructed the Benjamites, saying, go and hide in the vineyards and watch. And when the women of Shiloh come out to join in the dancing, rush from the vineyards, and each of you sees one of them to be your wife, and returns to the land of Benjamin. So you kind of get the feeling here that this is just mess multiplied on mess multiplied on mess. So here are these four girls. This is supposed to be a festival to the Lord, and they're going to go out, and you know they have, you know, Yahweh on their mind, and they're young, and all of a sudden some guy runs out, a dirty guy runs out of the bush that hadn't had a bath in 6 months, and grabs her, and just basically this is like caveman style, off we go back to my place. But it is... Genesis 6. So they took all they had seen. When the young women of Shiloh came out to join in the dancing, rush from the vineyards, each one of you, and seize one of them to be your wife, and return to the land of Benjamin.
Can I ask a question? That confused me.
Well,
verse 8.
Oh, I read that. I put that verse in there twice, didn't I? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
These daughters of one of the tribes, or am I looking at wrong Shiloh in the map?
They were, but because they weren't really participating, I guess, again, the lawyer thing. You know.
Did you read the part why they're doing that?
Right, because it's...
Then to take care of them, not giving them away.
So they're not really giving a tribe's daughter in marriage. They're taking them.
Yeah.
So again, the lawyers. Right. You know, this is lawyer speech.
Off on a technicality.
Off on a technicality. We didn't give them. We didn't give them. They took them, Lord. They took them. We didn't tell them yet. They just did it. Yeah. Well, here you're going to see the other side of that. It's even when the fathers and brothers complain to us, we will say to them, do us a favor of helping them because we did not get wise for them during the war. You will be guilty of break your oath because you did not give your daughters to them. So they didn't break the oath because they didn't give their daughters. They took them. So this is what the Benjamites did. While the young women were dancing, each man caught one, carried off to be his wife. Then they returned to their inheritance, rebuilt the towns, and settled down. And at that time, Israelites left that place and went home to their tribes and clans, and each to his own inheritance. And kind of interesting that the book ends on this verse. In those days, Israel had no king, and everyone did as they saw fit. So, again, just about every commentary you read on this book is going to focus on Israel had no king, because eventually you'll see that they clamor for one. And then everyone did as they saw fit, which in this book it is. You see, you know, we're human beings. I can rationalize anything. You know, and that's why, you know, grew up in another denomination that I kind of didn't understand when they were preaching, because the preacher would go from here to here to here to here. So I kind of like the expositional teaching of verse by, puts it kind of all in context, and I can't just go grab, you know, I can make the Bible pretty much say whatever if I wanted to, if I go stealing, you know, bits and pieces out of context and put it there. But I have to, so I'm always referenced back to Daniel, right? Daniel was taken captive in Babylon. Daniel did what he saw fit in his own eyes. But because of his family, because of his faith, and because of how he'd been raised, what was right in his eyes was what was right. So I'm not sure that's more a condemnation. Again, as I read through this book, it's more about the failure of the family. You never hear about them. The book of Deuteronomy was supposed to be read once a year, and the law was supposed to be taught at least once a year. And you never see that in this thing.
Ever, other than when they come back from Babylon.
Right. They never read the book. They never did. So basically, speculation, you know, that maybe if that law had been disseminated throughout the land, you see how many cases where people made idols and they thought they were doing the right thing, you know? The guy made an ephod. He had just won a great, great battle and he sets one of his kids up as a priest. And if you see all these failures, and you get the feeling out of the narrative at the time, they all think they're doing the right thing. They all think they're doing right. And I think it's a failure. And it's what's happened in our school system. It was like, again, back to a law term, fruit of the poison tree. So if you can poison the tree, everything that comes out of it is going to be horrible. When you poison our education system, it produces poisoned fruit. And that's what we're seeing. When you poison the family, you know, I mean, I honestly know people that I like and respect, you know, and all of a sudden they're going along in life and your daughter turns 17 and comes home and says, I'm a lesbian. You know, what do you do with that? You know, I mean, part of you wants to just say, no, you're not, stop this, you know. Part of it wants to, again, back to the compassion thing. I just don't know how you deal with that. But Satan has made one of his targets to destroy the family and destroy what was supposed to be where the fathers taught the sons, you know, the mothers taught the daughters, and, you know, just not hold up to. But it's really interesting. I saw a display, or I guess you call it a meme, is what the thing. But it had a woman in 1976, a picture, and I don't know what reason, she was showing her grocery bill to somebody, and somebody taking a picture. She had a cart full of food. It was $33. She was a stay-at-home mom. Her husband worked, and they put their kids through college. Right? In the 70s. That's how we're... Now today, you can barely make it on two incomes. They have twisted our lives around slowly but surely to the point that two people have to work, just about. I mean, for a mom to stay home is my, you know, my kids are starting to learn a little bit now because they're seeing their taxes and making money and stuff, but the commitment to be a stay-at-home mom is a heck of a thing. It's a tough thing, and we have designed a society, you know, where a car, we'll spend $70,000 on a car. You know, my dad...
You almost have to.
Yeah. My...
Now, see, that's what they tell you. And that's where people get sucked up into. You don't.
And the crazy...
You want to. There's a difference. The has and the want. My father was a big one on that one. So, technically, anything other than just dying to pay taxes... You don't have to. You don't even have to pay your taxes.
I laugh at. We had what top load dishwasher, laundry, you know, clothes washer. But, and I remember three times in my lifetime going down to my basement. My dad had that thing ripped apart, the tub out. There was just a little motor in there. You replaced the motor, put a new fan belt on it. You know, the tubs would get rusty because it sat upright. And you replace that stuff. That thing, they had it. I lived at my parents. I was like 25, in and out. But that washing machine was still there when I left. You buy a washing machine now for, and they probably paid $35 for it, you know, in 1972. You could spend $650 for a washing machine now that'll last you about a year before you have the first problem. As soon as the warranty runs out.
Yeah.
So you have to buy the extended warranty. You know, I mean, you go to Walmart and buy a mop, and they're like, do you want the warranty? Like, wow, interesting, you know?
Actually, you do need, I bought a mop in Target, and I used it one time, and the whole bottom was bad.
That's just how we've become, we've made everything disposable, even us. That's the crazy part. People don't realize the sinister people that are running a lot of things. If you think Pfizer and Moderna are here to make you healthy, no. Because if you're healthy, you're no longer a paying client. They're here to keep you alive and to keep you on whatever they've got you on. And once you pass away, they'll get the next guy. So it's just, you know, just look at, you know, growing up and what a doctor was when you were a kid and remember, you know, the kind of reverence your parents had for the doctor and all. And now they're money-making crazy people like everybody else knows them. You know? They swear a Hippocratic oath that they no longer could care anything about.
To do you no harm.
To do you no harm.
It's like when you found out that the people who were selling the virus computer software were actually the ones that had made the virus, and they made to buy the virus software. They were in cahoots that day.
Well, you gotta remember, it's the American people's fault. Because we never have enough.
I had absolutely nothing to do with any of it.
We
never have enough.
We never have enough.
Because if you look at it, you look at it back in the 70s, how many lawn care businesses were out there?
Now they're all over the place.
Why? Because American people got lazy. They don't even cut their grass. Well, it's cheaper than their... Well, I do too. I'm just saying,
no. You buy a mower that costs $2,000.
Yes.
You can pay somebody all year to do your yard for 2 years, and your mower don't last that long.
Yeah, I mean, everything's got...
That's what I'm saying.
It's kind of like that balance.
The American people's fault, because the stuff that was made in the 60s and 50s lasted.
Yeah.
But at that time, it was state-of-the-art. And as it went, then you got the cheaper models coming out. And people, I'll get the cheaper model. It'll last me long enough. Well, then what that did was that destroyed the companies that did the good models. It's progression of people.
Agree, but this goes back to, we can make the argument back to the two-family income.
Yes.
Post-World War II, a lot of women were in factories, so now you have two-income families. You know, where I work, there's like pictures of Rosie, because it was really an airplane factory that made bombers during World War II, so there were literally Rosie the Rippers there. And they were everywhere. So all of a sudden, World War II ends. Those ladies have, like, throughout, and you could throw the thing on. Men didn't take care of their wives the way they should. But anyway, now they have income, disposable income. They don't want to give that up. You know, I don't want to have to depend on anybody for my... And now, so all of a sudden, a car that used to cost $2,000 or $3,000 can now cost $4,000 or $6,000 because I could just double the price. Because most families have double the income.
And
the grand factor.
And less because you know they're very poor. And because there's places to make people look for a job.
And now there's, now built in with compute, you know just your computer. Like, I deal with this all the time. Your computer, after about 3 years, is like an antique. It's like a Model T. I don't care what computer you buy.
So
we have built in obsolescence in our cars. The parts that if you could get the state-of-the-art Tesla today that has everything, and in 5 years, that'll be, I think that's making a linear assumption that the world's going to be here in 5 years and whatever.
There you go.
Yeah. Genius. So, it's kind of crazy. And you can play, you just have to laugh about. Well, think about, did our soldiers win World War II? And you can make a case, to an extent. But men are men. What overwhelmed Japan and Germany was our ability to produce stuff. By the end of the war, we had a navy like 6 times bigger than Britain, which was the second biggest navy in the world. Because we were producing ships like, we could drop them out of the dock like every couple hours, another ship was dropping. It's like rabbits having babies. And here the rest of the world could not keep up with the production. So, they could fly kamikaze pilots in the ships, but we'd replace that ship in a week. Well, now we have no manufacturing base. When we go to war with China, and it's coming, it's just a matter of time, when we go to war with them or whatever, when they kick our butts, probably what's going to happen. We can't produce anything. We can't make anything.
We can't make bread. We have to get it from Ukraine.
Yeah. It's just what they just think. We don't even make our own fertilizer. We can't grow our own food. We can't. And
our own medication.
Yeah. All our antibiotics come from China. We're going to be in a world of hurt. But that's just Chris's political. But, back, not to get too far off from this. But you just see the seeds of... destroying the family, destroying the country, and just, the world is going to be yearning for a dictator soon, somebody to straighten this mess out. And,
Joey's ready.
It's scary to watch. I was just watching a thing on, they have just, right now, I read it right, I don't know how old the article was, but there's 7 red heifers in Israel that were flown from Texas that are being examined by and they have to be 2 to 3 years old, and they're a year old now. But they bought 7 of them that they need. This is for the purification of all the ritual implements that are going into the new temple. So.
And they have them ready.
Yeah. So you can read read this book and think it's a fairy tale, or you can watch what's going on around you and think, holy cow.
Literal.
So, yeah, holy cow. I'm assuming that's where it came from. So I wanted to take, I know it ended up getting a little late because I was running my face, but I just wanted anybody to give me what you got out of this. Did you get something out of this book that's applicable to what you're going through, what life has dealt you, what you see in life? Or did we, you know, I want to, if we're going to keep doing this, and that's the other thing we have to discuss, to make sure that I'm focused on, again, we could go through the Bible if you're really interested, like geography and the maps and the wars and who went here and who fought this and who did this. All that's really interesting, but the point of this is to see God and to see Jesus Christ in this. And I want to make sure that this is doing that, or I'm just clanging. Paul would call me a clanging cymbal, or certainly I clang too much. But anybody? Anybody get anything?
I think for me, it's showing me that it's really good to speak for the Lord daily, moving.
Like, you have to
because we're easily confused, wrong stuff, sin, you know, and that's just us. So it's really like impressing on me how important it is to be teaching our real Jesus.
That's
right. Because he's the only one that can do that.
And feel free to critique. If you think there's something we could improve on, do you want animation in the slides?
I want you to act it out.
We might have a preview of cartoons.
Yeah, we could do puppets. Maybe. Yeah. Anybody else? Anything?
That was my intention.
Good.
Made me realize that what you said, we have one hope, and it ain't the war of this world. And I, you know, when you're talking about the war, and you see how Satan has used every opportunity to destroy the fact. I mean, it's a spiritual, if you look at everything that, you know, it's all a spiritual battle. It's all. What you see in the physical, it's a spiritual thing. We're seeing all this because, yeah, they're playing it out in the physical, but there's something greater than this behind it, and it's all these. And it's been going on for a long. Unless we place our hope and trust in faith and constantly seek the Lord, I think we are hopeless. We are just hopeless.
Anybody else?
I had a question. How many of those guys in that conversation that came up with the story left their daughters here? think about it. Who would have let your daughter go out if you knew it was getting ready to happen?
None, I'm sure. Or I wouldn't do it.
Or they didn't care.
I got one. If you look at the progression of the story, it all started with undealt with sin. And if you read the beginning, you didn't need to know the end. Would you ever expect all those people to die from that sin? Think about it. It was a sin that nobody lost their life on until the sin got bigger than what it should have. And I think that's God's word to us. Sin can...
Little leaven's alone.
That's right. And it's very pronounced. It's extreme in this story. But it's possible. There. It tells us that it's bad. So
I thought about one, all those people killed because of one woman, and in the end they're worried about giving those people back with it.
You can't blame it on the woman. Because
yes, you can.
Man,
it's the woman you gave me, Lord. It's the woman you gave me.
The man the owes the sin. So you can't really blame just the woman. The man didn't do what sin.
Well, I know he didn't get any dowry. The man himself was taken from women. Yes. Don't they usually get dowries for something?
I shouldn't look up there. the thing with concubines is so convoluted and it so goes, I don't think anybody really knows, or we could sit down and like did a real, so for a concubine you only paid one goat, two mules, and a, you know, chicken. Compared to,
well,
right.
Is it any different? Is people living together for 20, 30 years?
Well, I'm just saying, is there a thing where...
Seven.
What state you're in? And
I can make the argument, if he had a concubine, doesn't that mean he had a wife?
Yes.
So you never hear her mentioned in the story. What did she say?
Well,
yeah. Well, he's like, well, I'm going to leave for
so it just didn't start with him.
Right. So, yeah. And every time in this book that is mentioned, it is trouble.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that.
All right. So, one thing we have to deal with right now is, what do we do next? I'll just give you, not to steer anybody anyway, but I was surprised. I just started reading in the room. And what I found was really, I didn't realize, I guess it never sat in on me, the beginning of the story, and it said, and this happened during the days of the judges. So I think it's really awesome that that story, out of this mess, comes that love story. So we can flow right into that. I had first thought I was going to skip over that because maybe we...
It was a woman.
No, it's just people have been through that so many times. But I was going to go to Samuel, but I think Ruth would be... It's a quick book. I say that. It's only four chapters, I should say. It's a shorter book. How's that? And I just think it has some really poignant points in it.
It's the redeeming part of Judges. So we can
yes.
see how the Savior comes through.
I mean,
because
yeah,
God's working within
yeah.
the mount with no king.
And just think about the fact that you don't know what the time frame is, but the Moabites tried to rule over Israel and they conquered it. Well, the family, Ruth's family, I mean, Naomi's family flees to Moab during a famine. So you don't really understand if Ruth, what it meant to be a Moabitess at that point. Either they were a conquered people and she was living under Jewish rule and they didn't like that, I'm sure, or the Jews were being pressed by the Moabites, which, so it makes sense when Boaz says, stay in this field because you're going to be in danger in other fields.
She was a Gentile.
She was a Moabite.
So it
yep.
God reaching out and accepting
to
Gentiles, even before.
So is everybody content with that? Is that a vote? Is that a...
Well, maybe we should call Ruth Ann and ask her.
No, I'm definitely just trying to look up the suits and looking up some other stuff. Another little twist on.
All right. On the book?
Yeah, on just the whole concept.
All right. Well, I appreciate you guys putting up with me. If somebody else wants to sit in the driver's seat for a while, I'm cool with that. I'll be willing to just come.
You're just getting on the
road. I was about to say, man, you're doing all
right. You're getting better and better. Yes.
I must have started out like you got to set the bar low.